Okay, now let's move on to the subject of capital punishment. Why are there so many things in ancient Israel that you could get killed for? And why the specific things? Why this and not that? Here's the way atheist Richard Dawkins describes it. He says the following offenses merit the death penalty: cursing your parents, committing adultery, making love to your stepmother or your daughter-in-law. Do you see the rhetoric? Do you see that? It's not committing adultery with your stepmother or your daughter-in-law. It's not completely betraying your father or your son's trust and sleeping with their wife. It's making love to your stepmother. It's almost like this real innocuous, harmless thing. Doesn't matter. Homosexuality, marrying a woman and her daughter, bestiality, and to add insult to injury, the unfortunate beast is to be killed too. You also get executed, of course, for working on the Sabbath. The point is made again and again through the Old Testament. So we have to ask ourselves the question, are these laws a little bit of overkill? Pun fully intended. Pun intended. Are these overkill? Why are people being killed for these offenses? Okay, some of them are serious, but others just seem downright strange. Well, remember principle number two. This is God's first law, not his final law. Some of these are probably barbaric, and it is extreme, but God was trying to limit brutality at the time. Secondly, laws of capital punishment were given for damaging people, not things. That's what's kind of interesting. When you look through the things that warrant capital punishment, it's never like stealing. It's never ruining someone's property, destroying their house. It's always if you mess with the faith or the family of Israel. If you mess with persons, in other words, messing with God, who's a personal being, or messing with someone's family, you know, sleeping with your stepmother, sleeping with your friend's wife, adultery, stuff like that. If you're messing with things, that's what warrants punishment according to Israelite law. Copan writes, he says, by contrast, the code of Hammurabi insisted on death for a thief, whereas the Old Testament demanded only double compensation for the loss. You know, if you were a thief in the ancient Near East, they thought that was bad. You stole somebody's stuff. You should be killed. And yet in the Old Testament, it was just like pay them back. If you get caught, you have to pay for that. Copan writes, on top of all this, in Babylonian or Hittite law, for example, status or social rank determined the kind of sanctions for a particular crime. So if you were rich, if you were an aristocrat, that's what fleshed this out. By contrast, biblical law held kings and priests and those of social rank to the same standards as the common person. That is a good freaking point. Think about when Nathan the prophet goes into David, he tells that little parable about the guy who's rich going over and stealing a lamb from another person's property. And he says, you know, what should we do with that man? And David, just trying to adjudicate the problem, just really briskly says, we should mess that guy up. That's completely wrong that someone with so much property and so much wealth should go and steal from someone else. And Nathan says, you are that man. You stole from Uriah. You stole Bathsheba. And I'm calling you out publicly. In the ancient Near East, you think anybody who's a prophet would go up to the king and call them out? No. The king would say, wait a minute, let me think about that. Oh, yeah, I'm the law, okay, not you. So I decide what's right and wrong, and I'll say, actually, I think you're the one who needs to be killed for that, not me. There's a difference between Rex Lex and Lex Rex. Rex Lex is that the king is law. In Israelite, it was lex rex, the law is king. The king had to come underneath the law of God. He was not above it. Nothing like it in the other ancient Near Eastern cultures. So, again, these actions, we're not required to uphold them morally. Remember principle two, there were laws for capital punishment for people, not things. And thirdly, Numbers 35:31 implies that most of these capital crimes could be paid for. Okay, let me read that passage to you. Numbers 35:31. You shall not take ransom. You can't be bought off. For what? For the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. Now think about what that implies. Okay, if you're a murderer, according to Israelite law, you are guilty of capital punishment, period. But it says you shall not take ransom for the life of a murderer. That implies that you could take ransom for the other laws that warranted capital punishment. It could be another example of lex talionis, that you could be paid for the damage that was incurred to you. And it would be the same principle. You slept with my wife. You need to be killed. How does 50 grand sound? No, I want you to die. Okay, how does 100 grand sound? Don't think so. 150. Okay, we'll try and work through it. We'll get some counseling. But you can imagine at the time, there was basically, if you do any of these things, that is a big deal. And you need to pay for that. Fourth thing we can point out under this whole heading of capital punishment is that we need to come to terms with a very important fact. Justice is messy in a fallen world. Okay, I don't know if there is a legal system that we can really just get behind and say, hurrah, that is the way to go. I mean, we're dealing with a fallen world, an ancient Near Eastern culture that was depraved and despicable. These are the laws that were given. You know, think about our modern legal system. Here's a picture of Johnny Depp, if you can recognize him from the 2001 movie Glow. He goes into prison. He was selling pot out in the West Coast. And he was just kind of a hippie back at the time, selling grass, and gets put into Danbury Prison. And he has a really interesting quote in this movie. He says, it's kind of a monologue. He says, Danbury wasn't a prison. It was a crime school. I went in with a bachelor's of marijuana. I came out with a doctorate of cocaine. Sadly, that is the case. Many people go into prison. They're not restored. They come out more hardened, more educated in crime. I mean, I'd like to say, I know you would probably like to say, too, that our legal system is there to restore people. I don't think I can say that, at least not in universal cases by a long shot. There is such a thing as the cycle of crime. I mean, are we going to say that our system is more moral than theirs? If it is, it's not much more moral. I don't think I need to convince you on that point. The prison system in our country, some of the atrocities that go on there, the hardening, people coming out more trained in crime, I don't even think I need to argue about that with you. I'm sure you've experienced that as well. If we're better, we're not much better. Just the idea of punishment in a fallen world is going to be messy, no matter how we look at it. Okay, let's look now at specific examples of things that warranted capital punishment. First off, let's look at the subject of false teaching. False teachers. Why were false teachers put to death in ancient Israel? Here's how Christopher Hitchens puts it in God Is Not Great. This was, for centuries, the warrant for the Christian torture and burning of women who did not conform. You know, when witches were put to death, the Bible says, suffer not a witch. Put false teachers to death. And he says, this is why people would kill witches, burn them alive, drown them. Okay, I'm not, obviously, not advocating killing innocent women. If you've ever read Miller's play, I'm blanking. The Crucible, thank you. It's kind of a satire of McCarthyism, but it basically describes in Salem, Massachusetts, where they were going through and doing a witch hunt. And none of these women were witches. They were just killing innocent people and men. They're killing a ton of people, about 30 people total. So I'm not advocating that. I think that's obviously wrong. Of course, we know that's wrong. However, I thought C.S. Lewis's response to this was pretty insightful. He says in Mere Christianity, surely the reason we do not execute witches is that we do not believe there are such things. If we did believe there were such things as witches, if we really thought that there were people going about who had sold themselves to the devil and received supernatural powers from him in return, and were using these powers to kill their neighbors or drive them mad or bring bad weather, surely we would all agree that if anyone deserved the death penalty, then these filthy Quislings did. I don't know what a Quisling is, but sounds pretty bad. He says, there is no difference of moral principle here. The difference is simply about matter of fact. What a great point. You know, it's like at the very end of the movie Dracula, when all the townspeople come up with stakes and spears and holy water and garlic, and they are trying to stab this demonic, you know, death-killing machine. No one ever sheds a tear for Dracula. They're okay with that. If there were such a thing as a demon-possessed person who was trying to inflict harm supernaturally on people, then it would make sense to execute them. Now, if you don't believe in stuff like that, then obviously that would be nonsense. But it's a matter of whether supernaturalism is true, if the Christian worldview is true. You can't just isolate one part of it. Lewis says it may be a great advance in knowledge not to believe in witches. There is no moral advance in not executing them when you do not think they are there. You would not call a man humane for ceasing to set mouse traps if he did so because he believed there were no mice in the house. So we could put it this way. Killing fake witches is moral madness, but killing real witches would be morally mandatory. If there really were people being used by Satan to inflict death and harm on others, then a person like that should be put to death. Moreover, we can point out for false teaching in general, false teaching in the ancient Near East was not similar to your kid coming back from a yoga class, as Sam Harris puts it in The End of Fate. It's not as though it was something harmless where people were learning how to stretch and hum or something like that and build up their core. Okay. Ancient Near Eastern false teaching believed in sacrificing your children to Baal or Molech or Moab. It believed in sacred prostitution, forced rape. It believed in tons of just horrific things. You know, our ideology and how we live is connected. As a man thinks, so he acts. And the Bible asserts that if someone is getting into extreme false teaching, this is going to have moral implications on the society. Okay, that being said, it's hypocritical for the critics to come down on passages like this because they're always flipping through the Bible and saying, oh, look at all this moral insanity and moral anarchy in the Bible. It's just so insane that there's so many moral issues that are just completely off the hook. And what's interesting is they will deplore and decry the Bible for being so immoral, but then they won't accept the solutions to insane, abhorrent immorality. So I think it's somewhat of a double standard on that point. Okay, what about adulterers? Why are adulterers put to death? Leviticus 20, verse 10, it says that adulterers are put to death. What is with that? Well, based on everything that we've said so far about, you know, our principle 2, principle 3, let me make one more point. In our culture, you can break into someone's house, steal their big screen, plasma screen TV. And if you get caught doing that, you get 5 years in prison. But if you sneak into someone's house and steal their wife, you get no penalty whatsoever. Now, think of the actual way that harms people. You know, adultery, by sleeping with someone's wife. Think of the effect that has on the marriage, on the family. You know, I would much rather come home and find my big screen TV gone than my wife gone. And yet in our culture, there is no, absolutely no punishment for adultery. So while it might seem extreme, we need to pause for a second and wonder, you know, I'm not advocating for adulterers to be put to death. We know that this has been abrogated in the new covenant, all of that. But I'm just saying, maybe we're the ones who have our values on the wrong things. Okay, what about disobedient kids? Deuteronomy 21, verse 18, and Leviticus 20, verse 9. We read in Deuteronomy 21, if any man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father or his mother, and when they chastise him, he will not even listen to them, then his father and mother shall seize him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gateway of his hometown. they shall say to the elders of the city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He's a glutton and a drunk. Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death. You shall remove the evil from your midst, and all Israel will hear of it and fear the Lord. Well, again, I don't want to keep regurgitating our principles. Principle one, principle two. But in addition to that, I'd also point out, in this case, the son didn't listen to correction. Verse 18, he was stubborn, obstinate, dug in. Second, it says he was stubborn and rebellious. It wasn't like people were trying to speak to him and he wasn't listening. This was a intentional, volitional action in the community. Verse 19 says he was a glutton and a drunkard. Well, that's not describing a little kid. Okay. It's not describing a 5-year-old misbehaving. We're talking about a grown man, stubborn, rebellious, out of control. He is just a bucking bronco. You can't control him. A glutton, a drunk. And it says not that the parents go and kill this kid themselves. It says that they take him to the governing authorities and they let them decide on what to do. It's not martial law. It's not vigilante law. It's actually taking this person before the community and then they get to decide what's right and wrong in this circumstance. If the parent felt like they could speak into this kid's life, then they would do that. Of course, this is a last case scenario being described here. And what about Sabbath breakers? Numbers 15:32. Why are Sabbath breakers put to death? Working on the Sabbath, what's the deal with that? Why is that such a big deal? Here's Dawkins. He says, he's commenting on Numbers 15, I believe. Yes. He's commenting on Numbers 15, where it describes this guy who's picking up sticks on the Sabbath, and all of Israel grabs him, ties him up, and stones him right there. Dawkins says in The God Delusion, page 275, did this harmless gatherer of firewood have a wife and children to grieve for him? Did he whimper with fear as the first stones flew and scream with pain as the fusillade crashed into his head? You know, isn't this just cruel and unusual? Well, number one, this attacked the faith of Israel. The other ones attacked the family or persons. Well, this attacked God. We find out that in the preceding passages, verses 27 to 31, that God goes through and gives a list of unintentional and intentional sins. And one of these sins is the Sabbath. Then in verse 32, immediately after that, on the tail end of intentional versus unintentional sins, this guy goes up and it was basically as if he was just going up and saying, okay, I'm going to do what I want today. Goes out, picks up firewood, and starts working immediately after the Sabbath was given. Now, if you're a Bible student, you know that by breaking the Sabbath, that was one of the reasons why the Jews were kicked out of their land. God made an agreement with them that in order to be in this real estate, I'll protect you from the ancient Near Eastern cultures and warfare if you follow my covenant. And it turns out that the people did, and it resulted in the exile. The prophets would never have been written if people had kept the Sabbath as well as a number of the other things going on in Israel. So we need to bear that in mind as well. What about flogging? Deuteronomy 25, verse 2. Then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall then make him lie down and be beaten in his presence with the number of stripes according to his guilt. Yes. Okay, so in this case, you're flogged according to what you did. It's not just universal. He may beat him 40 times, but no more, so that he does not beat him with any more stripes than these, and your brother is not degraded in your eyes. Here's a picture. I don't know if many of you remember this. Michael Fay. Anybody? Back in 1994, he was an 18-year-old kid in Singapore. He was popping tires, vandalizing cars. And the Singapore government told him, well, we're going to give you a fine, 4 months in jail, and 6 cane strokes. He was a U.S. citizen over in Singapore at the time. Well, this caused an international question of, is it okay to insist on corporeal, bodily punishment for an American citizen, even though in our culture we don't value this. Well, apparently President Clinton called over there, and it was a diplomatic affair where he lessened it to 4 cane strokes. But I remember at the time I was like, you could hit him 20 times. That kid was such a jerk, so arrogant, you know, vandalizing in another country. Okay, maybe not 20, but I felt like, you know, if that's the way they handle it, I'm not that messed up about that. Anyways, that was back in the 90s. Well, in this case, this culture did do that. And some cultures still insist on corporeal or bodily punishment. A number of observations can be made. First, there had to be a trial. It's not as though you could just pull out a cane and start beating someone. Second, this was the maximum penalty, not the minimum. Do you remember what it said? 40 strokes, but no more, lest your brother be degraded in your eyes. There was still a value for the person who had been caught. You don't want to overdo the punishment. And when we compare this with the ancient Near East, when we compare this idea of flogging with the ancient Near East, we see an incredible difference. Here's Copan on page 93. For certain crimes, Hammurabi's code insisted that the tongue, breast, hand, or ear be cut off. One severe punishment involved the accused being dragged around a field by cattle. In ancient Egyptian law, punishments included cutting off the nose and the ear. So getting a little flogging would have been humane in comparison.